Hello, everybody. I'm Jacopo Dettoni, and this is the FDI podcast. Cryptocurrencies have captivated public attention in the past months, shrugging off a reputation for being just a way to carry out illegal activities in the dark web. But it's now the technology that powers cryptocurrencies, the blockchain, that is taking center stage. The hype surrounding the blockchain has never been bigger. And even the financial and political establishment took blockchain at the World Economic Forum in Davos. The time is now for the blockchain, and developers all over the globe are rushing to design blockchain applications to use encrypted data on anything from money to medical records. But what can be the benefits of the blockchain for cross-border trade and investment? I'm here in our studio in London with Catherine Mulligan, co-director at the Center for Cryptocurrency Research and Engineering at Imperial College London. Catherine, thanks for being on the show.
A pleasure.
Kathy, let's start from the very beginning. Everybody's talking right now about blockchain, about the blockchain, but I still feel there is a lot of confusion around. So just to set the tone of the discussion, do you want to tell us what is the blockchain in a nutshell, if possible, and what is the difference between the blockchain and the cryptocurrencies?
Sure, fantastic. So, yeah, you're completely right. There is a big difference between a cryptocurrency and a blockchain, actually. So blockchain is the underlying technology. And what a blockchain allows you to do is it creates a ledger, a shared ledger between untrusting parties, if you will, and it allows them to co-create a permanent, unchangeable and transparent record of transaction. And it allows them to do this without relying on a central authority. And that's why it's become so popular within things like cryptocurrencies, because what it allows you to do is effectively remove the intermediary of the central bank. So that's why. So the difference is, you know, blockchain can be used in a multitude of different applications, and a cryptocurrency is very much about the exchange of value and money, if you will.
So definitely the characteristic of the blockchain, of any blockchain application, can trace back to the opportunity of developing a trusted set of data, an accessible set of data, at least for the stakeholders participating in the platform. Data can be quality data, as long as the providers of the data stick to some principles, and definitely also the security of the platform and the fact that it's a decentralized platform, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can think of it as a way to create consensus between people who otherwise wouldn't be able to do so.
Right. So, so where do you see opportunities for blockchain applications in cross-border investment and trade?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways we can view that, actually. So for me, I think there's a big opportunity for blockchain applications and the use of it for customs and streamlining customs interactions between nations. So where there's a border, you can track and trace much more quickly. And you can see countries like Singapore, for example, are investigating those kind of activities. I think blockchain in that sense as well would enable us to create regions. You know, countries who are not necessarily within the same border could create regions, trade regions for themselves using this technology. Within cryptocurrencies, I think we're seeing a lot of activity. So we're seeing a lot of smaller countries like Japan, for example, basically regulated for cryptocurrencies. Right. And we saw quite a huge influx of companies into the country at that particular point in time because they were very actively trying to work out how to build value from these type of cryptocurrencies. Yeah, so I think there is an opportunity to attract investment and trade. And of course, in terms of just countries which are able to build blockchain applications are going to see a lot more investment over the coming years, I think.
Right. Before getting there, I think that one of the reasons why of the current hype surrounding the blockchain is also the involvement of major global corporations in the development of blockchain applications and platform. And definitely within this space, one of them is IBM. IBM is definitely taking a lead as a provider for the blockchain technologies, and is teaming up with a number of different industrial partners to test these technologies across the board. And I met in London with Jason Kelly, who is the head of IBM Global Blockchain Services, and this is what he told me.
When you think about the vision forward for blockchain, when you have something that's more than just a technology, it's a capability something that's unlocking 2 years, which are both access to data, and then once you have that data, it's quality data. Something that I say often, that when you have those two things, now businesses can transact at a much faster rate with a higher sense of certainty. So that's this thought of a trust economy, because now it can be trusted. So once you have that, you know, where's the limit? If you can now open deeper than a supply chain, where there's no longer the lag in between each step in that value chain from production all the way out to the consumer, where permissioned parties can now see that an invoice has been paid, that a shipment has been delivered, that this product is in fact has the authenticity that you want for that product or service. With that being unlocked, you say, wow, that takes this value chain to a new level.
So IBM believes that the blockchain can take a business value chains to a whole new level, to use the phrasing of Mr. Kelly. And to make it happen, actually, they are teaming up, again, as I mentioned, with a number of major industrial partners. They are doing a joint venture with Maersk, a global shipping company, to improve the bureaucracy surrounding global trade. As you mentioned also before, probably like custom clearance and custom procedures that have historically had a name for being very, very time-consuming and definitely inefficient and vulnerable to a lot of corruption. But also, they are also teaming up, partnering with Walmart, for example, to create a safer food supply. And they are also launching a couple of initiatives with the European banks and Indian conglomerate Mahindra to explore the potential of the blockchain in the space of trade finance and supply chain finance. So here again, Jason Kelly on the potential of the blockchain as a catalyst for the development of digital business ecosystems.
Blockchain itself is just blockchain, but the capability that it brings is even more exciting, because it does serve as a catalyst for this elusive thing that we call digital reinvention. Because if you can set up that platform, and as you convene these players within the ecosystem, now what you've done is brought together a capability to say, well, this thing that was elusive now is real, because you can bring in digital reinvention by way of advanced analytics, cognitive, through a capable cloud secure platform. That then seeds additional change to innovate, to create new value, and give new access to new participants.
So, Kathy, do you see the blockchain as being really capable of driving a digital reinvention?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different ways we can think about that. So, for example, if we think about traditional technologies that we've had since the 1960s, they've been about doing the same business processes faster, more securely, and with higher throughput. What you get with blockchain is an opportunity to completely redefine how business processes are being done. Does that lend us towards a digital reinvention? Quite possibly it does. But it also brings with it a new set of issues and problems that we need to think through and overcome. So if you would like to have a supply chain, blockchain, for example, you have to get all of the parties who are members of that supply chain to agree. Exactly. And to negotiate what that blockchain is going to look like before you can even set it up. And I think another really interesting point that IBM was making there is they're talking about permissioned blockchains, which brings us to another point, which is there are lots of different types of blockchain. So the blockchain for Bitcoin is permissionless, so anyone can read, anyone can write, and anyone can become a member of that node, or a node on that network. Whereas what IBM is talking about is a permissioned blockchain, which is really useful for enterprise situations. So, only permissioned people can read that blockchain.
Right.
So those kind of solutions are really useful for, enterprises and supply chains and those sort of things, where you do still need a strong boundary of permission, access to the data.
And I would say that you also need strong principles to agree on. I mean, It's not enough that all the stakeholders participate in the blockchain, but everybody has to be committed to share their specific amount of data, and everybody has to be committed that that data has to be reliable, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in some of the proofs of concept we've done in the center, we've had some really interesting discussions, for example, around insurance, where the first thing that happens is all of the lawyers come into the room to negotiate the data sharing agreements, because, you know, that's a critical part of it. So who has risk, who holds the risk, those kind of things need to be rethought through when you're doing a blockchain.
Yeah. Actually, another very interesting development regards more specifically cryptocurrencies and initial coin offerings and countries that are trying to become a reference in this specific segment of the blockchain and cryptocurrencies. It's very interesting because you mentioned the case of Japan before, but there are other countries that are also trying to, again, to replicate the experience of Japan and become a center for ICOs, mm-hmm. smaller countries, and maybe countries that in the past used to have they still have much less access to traditional financial markets, so for them it's more difficult to raise capital through normal IPOs. But ICOs, initial coin offerings, maybe give them an extra opportunity to raise capital through untraditional sources, and I specifically referring, for example, to Eastern Europe, Baltic countries like Lithuania and Estonia are definitely taking a lead there in the European Union space, but also countries outside the European Union like Switzerland. There is an initiative in Switzerland called the Crypto Valley. Gibraltar, they are about to launch their ICO market called renamed the Crypto Harbor. Talking about this, I met with Antonas Guoga, who is also better known as Tony G. Antonas is a poker legend from Lithuania, but he's also a blockchain entrepreneur. But even more interesting, he's also a member of the European Parliament. So he's got a very good perspective there because he is an entrepreneur in the blockchain space, but he's also a legislator at the same time at the European Union level. And this is what he told me.
Now this has been a revolution. You know, there's been so much money raised by people in Lithuania, in Estonia, all over Europe, Slovenia, and it's fantastic. I mean, these countries that didn't have access to capital markets, and they never had strong stock exchange, they don't have VCs, very low liquidity. Now, by having a decentralized environment, they're raising a lot of money. The question is it a security, is it legal? So, yeah, we need to have good regulation on this to allow them to do these things, but not to stop them, to encourage them, but also to give a little bit of protection, or as much protection as we can, to the investors. And this money flow is basically from a lot of money flow from China and from Asia into Europe to provide the blood that we need, the capital that we need to build great projects. And from some of these projects, you'll have unicorns. You'll have very successful, huge projects, which, you know, we need to dream about building companies as big as Google in Europe. This is what we must do, and this is a way that gives us a chance. So we can't stop this. We don't want to stop this. This is an opportunity for us.
So a big opportunity for a number of European Union countries, for smaller European Union financial, traditional financial markets, but also a challenge for European Union legislators. Kathy, what do you make of all this?
Well, I think that the ICO space is a super fascinating thing to look at, and it's really quite exciting. I think there are a number of issues that have obviously been raised already around the role of regulation. So is an ICO a security? And we can see that the SEC in the United States is making quite a lot of, or it's been rattling its cage, shall we say, over this last year. And it's actually launched a few cases against what they consider to be fraudulent ICOs. I guess the other issue about that is there is precedent where the SEC has sued overseas. So even if you know, Switzerland or Gibraltar were to set up these ICOs, they still have to conform with security law if they're selling to US citizens. Right. So that's a really interesting thing that I think you can see in cryptocurrencies. They're effectively international currencies. It's a borderless currency. Bitcoin doesn't have a national boundary to hold it. And that's where we're going to have to see a lot more interaction between governments. So, you know, more governments are going to have to understand how to regulate these. They're going to have to understand how to regulate them together. A very interesting, you know, problem in that space is there is no universal definition of money. So how do you define a cryptocurrency, actually? So it's a really fascinating time. I think, however, the idea about using it, ICOs, as a means to sort of create the next unicorn or the next Google in Europe is a really fascinating one. Because I think what an ICO does in Europe is it allows you to get around what are really quite archaic innovation programs. For example, if you traditionally start up a company in the EU, you have to go to the EU sort of H2020 funding or the SME programs that they have. And the decision-making processes behind those are really quite slow. They're a bit clunky. Right. Mm-hmm. You don't really know who's making the decision. And it's not that dissimilar in the UK, actually. So, you know, you've got Innovate UK or different sort of funding agencies, not picking on anyone in particular, but very, very...
There is a lot of bureaucracy and it's time-consuming procedures behind it, yeah?
Exactly, and it's very low probability of success as well. So, you know, in a sense, the ICOs can be used to sort of help overcome that, because what an ICO is effectively doing is putting an idea out there and saying, what do people actually really think of this? So it's a great way, I think, for people to vote. But of course, then we do have the issue around consumer protection, because these currencies are not protected under law.
Actually, last year, ICOs all over the globe raised more than $3.4 billion. So it's already, it's not in the financial space, it's not a huge sum, but it's already a very tangible reality out there. And even more importantly, this is an almost completely unregulated market. Still,
exactly.
So it's something that legislator must be looking at increasingly, and even more so as the whole phenomenon develops. This year, Telegram, the messaging app, plans to raise $2 billion, also in an ICO. So definitely is a space that will attract more and more, will draw more and more attention from legislators. And it will be interesting to see how the debate, you know, unfolds, whereas the side of a better and now regulated market, better no regulation at all to keep the market flexible and to keep it with the characteristic that you were mentioning, or whether the other side more hawkish on regulation would eventually prevail. But actually, it's interesting to see this debate unfolding within the European Union, because, again, as I mentioned before, there are countries like Lithuania and Estonia and Slovenia that are taking the lead in the development of DSL, the blockchain space and cryptocurrencies. And they had a sort of a mild, coldish response from European Union authorities. For example, Estonia proposed at some point to launch a government-backed cryptocurrency called S-Coin. And this proposal prompted the response of the European Central Bank governor himself, Mario Draghi, who said basically, in other words, said that this is not going to happen, that the European Union currency is the euro, and everybody will continue using euro instead of other cryptocurrencies. And I spoke about this to David Anderson. David is a co-founder of SweetBridge, a blockchain-based solution for supply chain finance. And I think he has got an interesting point on how smaller jurisdiction outside the European Union space can actually gain an edge here. And this is what he told me.
I think that the advantage of the smaller jurisdictions, and let's take an example of the Canton of Zug, Gibraltar, Liechtenstein, you know, amongst to name a few, they're more or less free to set their own regulation and financial rules, you know, around listing, exchanges, transfer, blockchain. So there is an opportunity for the United Kingdom, perhaps tumbling out of the European Union with Brexit, to have more freedom. And we see various members of the EU trying to do things and being told to get back in their box, effectively. So there's innovation happening very quickly in Estonia and Lithuania members. You can also see the US being tied by the fact that there are different laws governing the exchange of money in the 50 different states, different licenses required for each one. So, you know, when is that all going to be changed? Well, as it stands this morning, I think the government's back in action, but they were out of action yesterday. So I don't think that's on the top of their list to get through. They're not going to make the 50 states law uniform, and you're battling with that every time you want to change, unless they can change that. The UK has a chance, being an enormous financial centre, to attract investment if it shows some innovation. And the model I would follow would be the efforts made by Gibraltar, who are churning out a huge amount of legislation, requirements, and embracing the blockchain and saying, here we are, we're open for business, come and do this here. Britain's, I don't know, 100, 1,000 times larger as a financial centre, and, you know, it has a great opportunity to make something out of it.
So, yeah, Cathy, do you think that the UK has got an opportunity here to take a lead in the cryptocurrency ICO space?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the very fact that it is one of the world's largest financial centres does give it that, you know, very strong base to build from. Also, London, for example, has been working and creating more around the fintech as well, the sort of technology. So they're quite advanced in this space. It's certainly not unheard of. But I guess in the same way that the United States government is currently trying to get itself out of a shutdown, you know, Brexit is overtaking everybody's conversation right in the government. And I think it's a fantastic idea that we could use Brexit as an opportunity to do that. But I think we've got other things to worry about.
Yeah. So probably we will see this center, Gibraltar, and the Crypto Valley in Switzerland, being more successful in that, and not exclusively like in Europe. There are also other countries. For example, an interesting case is Belarus. Belarus is also trying to open up its a digital space to blockchain startups, ICOs. Russia is sort of taking a similar attitude towards cryptocurrency mining, but also the blockchain. So it's interesting how there are different countries in different jurisdictions, different regions that are trying to open up to capital interested in these developments. Whereas on the other hand, there are other countries like China, for example, cracking down on ICOs and cryptocurrency mining. South Korea, another big market that used to be another big market for cryptocurrencies, cracking down on cryptocurrency exchanges. So there is a lot of development there and a conflicting development there.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's really interesting is how some of these governments are seesawing. So originally, you know, Putin released that he wanted to crack down on all cryptocurrencies. Right. Now he wants to attract ICO investment. What we see is, you know, China actually at the beginning, I think it was January of 2017, they announced that they were looking at putting the renminbi onto a cryptocurrency base. So I think it's really fascinating that there's this fluctuation, and it does show that, you know, that regulatory uncertainty is actually really difficult for companies to deal with as well. So I think that those countries that are able to give a robust and stable regulatory environment, so companies know how much tax they're going to pay, how they're going to be treated, all of these kind of, you know, usual things, will be the country that actually sort of attracts the most investment first. I think with regards to things like Estcoin, and also I think the, you know, Riksbanken, the Swedish central bank is also about looking at using cryptocurrencies. I think that many of those things are really sort of more in the research stage. And the reason for that is obviously its impact on macroeconomic policy. So are you a deflationary economy or an inflationary economy? I mean, those are questions that have to be re-asked if you look at fiat-based cryptocurrencies. So I think it's a really exciting time for that. But I think, you know, these trials, I think it would be nice to see some trials around a fiat-backed cryptocurrency. So I think, you know, could they do a proof of concept in Estonia? That would be quite nice to see.
Right. I think that in this space is also very interesting. The development of cryptocurrencies as a way to hedge foreign exchange risks. And this is pretty evident in countries that have historically suffered from very erratic foreign exchange rates. Zimbabwe, obviously, it's an example that many people often mention, and it's also very actual given the recent developments in the country. And it's actually interesting to see how Bitcoins and Ethereum are traded at a substantial premium in a country like Zimbabwe, because many people are shifting their savings from foreign currency into, which is very scarce nowadays in Zimbabwe, into Bitcoins or Ethereum. And this is happening not just in Zimbabwe, in other countries. So again, this is, as you were mentioning before, these are borderless currencies or borderless assets, largely unregulated, and definitely independent from any political entity, political influence, as far as we know, as far as they were engineered. Mm-hmm. So do you see potentially also the Bitcoins, other cryptocurrency, becoming a safe haven for savers, but also for investors to hedge against forex risks in developing countries, but also developed countries with foreign exchange risks?
Yeah, I mean, when I speak to people who are investing sort of in Bitcoin and Ethereum and those kind of things over the last few years, a lot of people became much more interested in Bitcoin after the Brexit vote, mainly because of uncertainty. So they're starting to view Bitcoin and Ethereum as a more certain bet than potentially the sterling, which is a very, very interesting thing to watch. And also, I think that, the United States government is probably not helping stability either. So, you know, yes, I think a little bit of that is the case, definitely.
And obviously, I guess this argument is stronger now after the huge rally of the Bitcoin and Ethereum, with their valuation spiking up in the currency markets. But maybe it wouldn't be the same in a year's time if their market value plummeted, right?
Yeah, so I think it's been really great. Over the last couple of months, we've seen what can only be described as the greatest wealth creation mechanism, probably at least for the last 30 years, let's face it, right? And we could also see the greatest wealth decrease.
Of course. So these currencies, they are independent from political influence and from central bank decisions, but still they are very immature, say early stage markets. Liquidity is not really there. It's not as big as in normal currency markets that are the most liquid assets out there, and so fluctuations and volatility can still be a huge factor to take into account.
Exactly. And you know,
all right, well, Kathy, to wrap up, I got a statistic that I think that is very symbolic for what we are experiencing, what we are seeing in the blockchain and cryptocurrency world, universe. Last year, according to estimates by consultancy company Deloitte, there were as many as 26,000 new projects initiated in the blockchain space or involving the development of blockchain technology. And I was talking to one of the speakers at the Blockchain London Week here in London on January 24th, a few days ago. And he told me that we are going through the crypto winter. This is how he phrased it. And I imagine that if I met him in a 2 months' time, he would tell me, oh, this is the crypto spring. And then there would be the crypto summer and the crypto autumn. However, the level of success of these initiatives, of these 26,000 new projects, has been relatively small. So only 8% today, after a few months, of these initiatives are still active. So I wanted to ask you to wrap up. If we look forward, where do you see the defining moment for these initiatives to become more successful? And where do you see the blockchain in 5 years' time?
Yeah, so I think the tipping point for me will be where we see this blockchain solution move beyond a proof of concept. What we have today is a lot of proof of concepts, and that's what the 26,000 are. When I hear that, you know, let's say a very large corporation or set of corporations has decided to put their data exchanges onto the blockchain, and then moving away from their legacy systems, that for me is the tipping point. That is when we're starting to move in towards a new data management era. With regards to where it will be in the next 5 years, I think it's going to be a fascinating journey. I think we'll have seen a lot more volatility in the prices of cryptocurrencies, and I think we'll start to see people potentially trying to use the currencies within industry structures. So I think you could see, for example, I don't know, some kind of insurance coin or some kind of, any kind of industry coin, rather than an actual national currency coin. So I think that international industries could have a lot of value delivered to them by a coin which is unique to their industry.
Right.
So, for example, a travel coin. Yeah. You could actually remove a lot of fluctuations, again, around the exchange of foreign currencies. If you could remove that uncertainty from their supply chain, they could actually save a lot of money. So I think those kind of things are what we'll see in the next 5 years.
All right. Well, Kathy, thank you very much for being with us today. Tell us, how can listener access the research that you guys are doing at the Center for Cryptocurrency Research and Engineering?
I think the easiest way is just to look on the Imperial College homepage or Google us, and you can find us quite quickly.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks again. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can all find our podcast on our website, fdiintelligence.com/podcast, and on any other major podcast platforms like iTunes or Acast. Thanks again. Stay tuned.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.